The things exhibited as the result of the opening of the seventh seal are more numerous and complex than the events of any of the other seals. It would have been clumsy and confusing to have exhibited them simply as the elements of the seventh seal. They are therefore divided and subdivided under several heads, so to speak, but all these separate heads forming part of the seventh seal. There's also a striking appropriateness in the introduction of a new set of symbols. They were to mark a new system and relations between God and the people of the Roman Empire. Up to this time, Europe had been the avowed adversary of Christ under the leadership of paganism, but now these peoples, organized under the leadership of Constantine, were professedly subject to him. The name of Christ and the law of obedience to him were adopted as the basis of the state religion. This was a great change. It was natural, therefore, that the change should be recognized. The seals merely exhibited the experience of pagan Rome during her conflict with Christianity. With a profession of Christianity, there was a more direct political responsibility to Christ, so to speak. It was therefore seemly that the prophetic seals should now be succeeded by other symbols, intimating a more direct causation of the evils that were to be inflicted on the European body politic. This we find in the seven trumpets. The seventh seal having been opened, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Peace in the ruling realm is here foreshadowed as the result of Constantine's triumph over paganism. The half hour is, of course, not a half hour by the clock. It is a larger half hour than even the day for a year principle of interpretation. The actual interval of peace was close on 15 years. What sort of a day of 12 hours, for this was the duration of a day with the ancients, would be required to make nearly 15 years about half an hour? Well, call 15 years half an hour. 30 years would be an hour. And this multiplied by 12 gives us 360 years for a day. 360 days was the length of the ordinary ancient year, and as a day was prophetically used to represent one such ordinary year, we have one such year treated as a day by the clock. But each day of it is taken to represent a year. It is duplicated, so to speak. A day of the clock is taken for a year, and then this year, as consisting of 360 days, is again taken to stand for 360 years. This is condensing time in harmony with the fitness of John's situation as a listener and beholder of the symbolic things seen in Patmos. For John to have witnessed a 15 years or even a 15 days silence would have been unnatural, but by drawing in the time twice, 15 years were condensed into half an hour. At the end of the 15 years, judgments were casting their coming shadows over the scene. The church triumphant under Constantine became as great a persecutor of the true and faithful disciples of Christ as ever the pagan emperors had been. God was about to bring a series of scourges on the persecuting church in retribution. They were scourges to come directly at the divine call. Therefore, seven angels are seen to receive seven trumpets, with which they were successively to summon these judgments on the scene. Before they begin to sound, another angel comes to the altar with a golden censer, with which he offers incense with the prayer of all saints. The golden altar is Christ. The angel with the censer is the representative of the saints in the attitude of prayer. And there was special need for prayer at this time. The true saints were being oppressed and afflicted greatly by the dominant church, which could not tolerate their dissent from its dicta and their protest against its unchristian ways. Prayer to God was the only weapon of defense left them against their enemies. And the answer to their prayers is here symbolized. Having offered the incense with the prayers of all saints, the angel took the censer and filled it with fire at the altar and cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. The history of the 30 years succeeding to the death of Constantine in AD 337 is the best illustration of the import of this symbolism. Faction and strife and bloodshed among his sons, and civil war consequent on the revolt of a military officer, Magnentius, aiming at and for a time wearing the imperial purple, ended in the elevation of Julian, a votary of paganism, to the throne of the empire. This political earthquake was a terrible calamity to the Catholic Church, at whose instigation the persecutions were conducted, for which these were retributive public disasters. The elevation of Julian led to an attempt to restore paganism to the position it held before the victories of Constantine. This attempt, though not finally successful, was sufficiently formidable to subject the bishops and adherents of the Catholic Church to great tribulation. Particulars may be read with much interest in Eureka. The voices and the lightning and the thunder and the earthquake, having expended themselves in the accomplishment of their mission, the seven angels prepared themselves to sound. Their soundings and the results ensuing, we must reserve for the next lecture. The fifth lecture. In the last lecture, we completed our survey of the events symbolized by the imagery of the seals, and in the consideration of the seventh seal, we were introduced to the seven trumpets. That is to say, we found the events of the seventh seal to consist of the sounding of seven trumpets by seven angels and the events ensuing upon those soundings. The seventh seal consists of the multitudinous details connected with the sounding of the seven trumpets. And tonight it will be our duty to look at the things represented by the trumpets. The common run of people laugh when we talk of the seals and trumpets and vials, and the uncommon run of people too. The respectable and the learned take part in the jest. Their mirth is entirely misplaced. Granted that these terms are so much jargon to the generality, but their uncouthness is due not to the subject itself, but to the general non-acquaintance of the people with them. They are the technicalities of the most advanced chapter in the Bible. The technicalities of any subject are barbarous to those who are not acquainted with them. But to make them the ground of scorn is an aggravation of ignorance. It reminds us of the words of Solomon, "Wisdom is too high for a fool. The apocalypse is a great deep. There is a wisdom and beauty in it that impart an ecstasy of admiration when the mind opens to them. It not only imparts knowledge of the future, but it does so in a system of symbolism that is symmetrical in structure, complete in plan, distinct and vigorous in detail, and perfect in the appropriateness of its figures. This is not obvious all at once. It's not obvious at all to those who are ignorant of the first principles of divine truth as revealed in the writings of Moses and the prophets, interpreted in harmony with the apostles. And even to those who know the truth, it is dark for a while, only after patient study of the book of God, for a long time, the excellence of the apocalypse is appreciated. For a time, the matter of the apocalypse seems wild, austere, high, hard, perhaps inscrutable, something unpractical, something not useful. such impressions are due to spiritual infancy. Men ought to condemn themselves for such feelings. They ought to be very modest. They ought to assume, if not able to perceive, that the apocalypse must be wise and useful because an emanation of the divine mind. We must not set ourselves up as the standard of judgment. We're all fools to start with, if not to finish with. The first step in true progress is to know that we are ignorant. There is hope when we realize this. But seest thou a man wise in his own conceit? Solomon says, there is more hope of a fool than of him. When we start with a right idea of ourselves, we shall be as little children, as Jesus prescribes. We shall not measure everything by our impressions and conceptions. We shall not set ourselves up as the standard. We shall recognize that there must be things as much higher than our conceptions as heaven is higher than our puny stature of 5 or 6 feet. Recognizing this, we shall be prepared to ask what they are. If we can know them and receive them in humility, however hard of apprehension, instead of scornfully rejecting them because higher than ourselves. This is a long step in the direction of wisdom, to know that we are small and know nothing. Any other attitude is the attitude of fools, and it is written that God taketh no pleasure in fools. God is wise, as manifest in our own mechanism and in all nature around. Because the apocalypse is his, it bears the impression of his wisdom, which, however hard to receive at first, becomes a cause of joy and thanksgiving. We have looked at the significance of the seals. We found a scroll introduced, sealed with 7 seals, as illustrating the concealment in the mind of God of certain knowledge of future events affecting Christ and his people. We found that Jesus was alone esteemed worthy to unloose those seals or obtain access to that knowledge, the impartation of which by the Father to him qualified him to carry out the program written in the symbolic scroll. We've seen him break seal after seal or exhibit one after the other the events destined to occur in the various periods covered by the seals. We've come to the 7th and find the figure changed. It is no longer a mere disclosing of what course affairs would take in the Roman Empire as affecting Christ and his brethren. It is a blowing of trumpets to summon events, so to speak, to bring judgments on the scene. We all know what a trumpet blast is and for what it is used. It is mostly an instrument of military use to direct the movements of large bodies of men who could not otherwise be made aware of the will of the commander. Such an instrument, when used as a figure, must mean the urgent causing of unpeaceful events. Apocalypse is not the first place in the Bible where the figure is used in this sense. Thus we read in Jeremiah 4, "Blow ye the trumpet in the land, cry, gather together, and say, assemble yourselves, and let us go into the defense cities." Again in Hosea 8, "Set the trumpet to thy mouth. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant." And again in Joel 2, "Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain." Doubtless these allusions to the blowing of the trumpet originated in the use of trumpets and the convoking of the assembly of Israel in the wilderness as they came out of the land of Egypt, in the monthly blowing of trumpets at the new moons, as enjoined. Still, they exemplify a figurative use which finds its boldest illustration in the seven trumpets blown by the seven angels of the seventh seal. But what was there calling for a different style of symbolism from the seals? The contemplation of the events of the sixth seal will supply the answer to this question. There was an entire change in the situation. Up to that time, paganism was on the throne of the world, and the Roman Empire, an empire of idolatry in consequence. Now, concerning nations in that position, it is written that God had suffered them to walk in their own ways. It's found in Acts chapter 14. On the principle that to whom little is given, little is required, and that the ground of condemnation is divine relation and responsibility. Amos 3. Nations, like men, though in honor, if they have no understanding, are as the beasts that perish. This was the relation of the Roman polity to the divine law under the pagan Caesars. Rome was the political incorporation of the ignorance that is natural to man in relation to all divine things. But there was a change when Constantine came to the throne and when the state was organically allied with the profession of the name of Christ. The friends of Christ for a time found themselves under the shadow of the throne. The scriptures were accepted as the law of the state. A new order of things arose with the name of God written upon it, so far as professed subjection was concerned. It was therefore natural that with such a change in the constitution of things in the world, there should be a change in the symbolism expressive of its divine relations. It was appropriate, too, that the new symbolism should be representative of a higher degree of responsibility than attached to pagan Rome. The trumpets certainly were so. They intimated a direct bringing or causing of judgments on the Roman body politic in its new relation on account of its wrongdoings against Christ, instead of merely an unfolding by seal breaking of things that were to come. The use of the trumpets is related to judgment. This we've already looked at some illustrations from the prophets. It finds a rudimentary type in the destruction of Jericho. In fact, the sea scheme of the apocalypse would seem to find a foreshadowing in the mode adopted to bring that destruction about. The Israelites were to march around it in 7 days, the priests blowing trumpets of ram's horns as they march, and on the seventh day they were to march around the city 7 times, after which the city should fall into their hands. A certain analogy will be perceived between this and the seven seals, the last of which contains the seven trumpets, the last of which again contains the seven vials, and the last of these, the seven thunders, as the result of all of which Babylon falls, and the world comes into the hands of Christ and his brethren. The Bible abounds with beautiful analogies, and this seems to be one of them. We are introduced to the sounding of the trumpets in chapter 8. Verse 6 informs us that the angels who received the seven trumpets on the opening of the seventh seal prepared themselves to sound. A careless reading would pass this over, but by the hand of Dr. Thomas, God has taught us to read the apocalypse with carefulness instead of carelessness. There is nothing superfluous in the wording, nothing put in to fill up. There is a meaning to everything. The preparation to sound has a meaning. There was, in point of fact, a period of providential preparation for the judgment events of the trumpets. Each of the trumpets brought invaders upon some part of the Roman Empire, so exactly appropriate was the use of the trumpet to this part of Roman history the trumpets summoning armies to move. There was a preparation for these invasions, an opening of the way to the invaders. And these invaders in the first instance were mostly the barbarians who occupied the northern parts of Europe. The way had to be paved for their incursions and for their ultimate triumph over the military discipline of Rome. This occurred during the reign of Jovian, the successor to Julian, who came first after Constantine. The Roman Empire was confined to the south of the river Danube. The territory to the north of that river was as little known to the Romans then as Central Africa is to us. The most that was known was that it was occupied by fierce and warlike tribes, whose barbarism and want of discipline, however, rendered them somewhat powerless, and from these causes they were for centuries easily kept at bay. But a change came when the time arrived to prepare for the judicial trumpets. This change occurred in its most marked form during the reign of Jovian, just before the commencement of the trumpets, a reign that we must consider as the preparation period of verse 6. It originated in a struggle that took place between two of the barbarian races, the Goths and the Huns. In this struggle, the Huns obtained the advantage, and the Goths, being hard pressed, asked permission of the Roman generals to cross to the southern side of the Danube to escape from the molestations of their successful enemies. The Roman generals consented, and the Gothic nation came over and settled in Illyricum, a district corresponding to modern Bosnia and Herzegovina, of which the world has recently heard so much. This was the beginning of the trumpet visitations, or rather the preparation for them. The Romans no longer had the Danube as a barrier between them and the barbarians. The barbarians were in their midst, so to speak. Goths grew numerous and formidable, and to avert the danger of their presence, the Romans decided to take them into their pay as military auxiliaries. They gave them arms and money and taught them the art of war and used them as an addition to the Roman army. The measure, which was intended to make them harmless and allies, had the opposite effect. It converted them into a formidable foe, and the Goths gradually woke to a sense of their power, and as the hour was approaching for the blast of the first trumpet, the Goths were getting into position for the work they had to do in obedience to its summons. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. Just realize the scene. After a getting ready pause, a clarion blast breaks upon the stillness of the air, and when the notes die away, there's the descent of hail, and you observe the forked lightning gleam and hiss here and there in its midst. And on the ground you see streamlets of blood and scorched vegetation. This is a striking piece of symbolism. Let us glance at the events symbolized. You will observe that the hail and fire were said to be cast upon the earth, that this was the Roman jurisdiction we have already seen under the seals. There is nothing strange in limiting the earth to the Roman Empire. It was the seat of civilization, outside of which all was social waste and desert. It was the arena upon which the Spirit of God was developing its work by the gospel. Therefore, it was natural to speak of it as the earth, or habitable, in contrast with the regions and countries outside of it, from which came the elements of the judgments brought on Rome by the trumpets. You will observe, however, that only a third part of the earth was affected by the trumpet. This ought to read the third, which gives the key to what is puzzling at first. In the period to which it refers, the three sons of Constantine divided the Roman world among them, the Eastern, the Western, and the Central. Thus, the Roman Empire was in three parts. The central third was the third, the Roman third peculiarly, because comprising the seat of government. Upon this, then, our attention is fixed, the part of the empire to be affected by the hail and fire. What came, as a matter of fact? In answer to this, we look at the barbarians admitted to the south of the Danube. There were the Goths escaping from the Huns. But the Huns and the Goths became friendly, and the Huns wanted to emigrate southwards as well. They applied for the permission of the Romans. The Romans refused, but the Huns came without their consent and added a new swarm, very dangerous neighbours to those already too near them. The Goths, nurtured by the Romans and perceiving the growing weakness of their masters, became exacting in their demands. They wanted more pay and privileges than the emperor would consent to, and his refusal was the letting loose of the judgment events of the first trumpet. War broke out between the Romans and the Goths. A series of battles were fought in which the Romans were worsted and the emperor himself finally slain. And the result was the establishment of Gothic independence under a chief who became their king, Alaric, a barbarian of fierce nature and considerable military talents. And by and by this Alaric felt his strength and resolved, without the delays and circumlocutions of diplomacy, to lay the greatness of Rome in the dust. He assembled a large army of disciplined barbarians and marched for the northern entrance of Italy. Prior to passing into Italy itself, he went westward and ravaged the beautiful provinces owing allegiance to Rome in that direction. The hail and the fire did their work effectually. The banks of the Rhine, which were crowned with elegant houses and well-cultivated farms, were laid waste. Suddenly, without warning to the unsuspecting inhabitants, the scene of peace and plenty was changed into a desert, and wide, prosperous districts in an instant became smoking solitudes. 17 provinces of Gaul were subjected to this devastation. In 2 years, the horde of barbarians, increasing in violence by new accessions, swept over and desolated the whole of the country lying between the Alps, the ocean, and the Pyrenees. They drove the inhabitants before them in frightened crowds everywhere, that is, such as could escape their ruthless swords, carrying with them as much as they could rescue from the wreck of their houses and churches. In AD 408, Alaric turned his march towards Rome itself. He passed the Alps and the Po, and proceeding along the eastern sea coast of Italy, made an easy prey of many cities which he gave over to the pillage of his soldiers. Arrived before Rome, he commenced siege operations against the city which had been the unquestionable mistress of the world for ages and had never been dishonored by the presence of a foreign enemy. The experience of Jerusalem at the hands of Rome 4 centuries previous was now returned upon Rome's own head. Famine prevailed in the city. Hunger dissolved the restraints of law and order. They murdered one another and devoured the bodies of their victims. Even mothers ate their slaughtered infants. Many thousands of the inhabitants expired in the streets and in their own houses for want of food, and the stench arising from their unburied bodies revived the scenes of Jerusalem. At length, Alaric accepted an enormous sum of money to retire, but it was only for a short time. The negotiations for peace fell through, and Alaric returned, and another siege followed with increasing horrors, and a third in the next year. And in the third siege, the Goths obtained admission, and the city was given up to pillage. In 6 days, the Goths marched southward and carried fire and sword into the southern provinces of Italy. And while so engaged, Alaric died, and the fire and hail mingled with blood had expended themselves to the destruction of the green grass and trees, the respectable population of the central third of the Roman earth. After this, there was an interval of peace. In 20 years, the time came for the second trumpet to sound. This was to affect the sea. A great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures that were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. We have already had to notice the mixing of the literal and symbolic as a characteristic of the scenes of the apocalypse. The sea used symbolically stands for the populations of the earth, but here the sea is used geographically as indicative of the section of the Roman Empire next to be affected, namely the maritime parts all along the coasts of the Mediterranean. Further on, the Euphrates is used symbolically of the power occupying Euphratian territory, and yet its employment is a literal indication of the territory where the power is to be found. In this, there is mixture without confusion. The public are accustomed to it in the political cartoons of the day. Mr. Gladstone digging a grave for religious texts within sight of the Houses of Parliament in the background is a picture misunderstood by none, though blending the literal and symbolic in a very marked manner. The symbolic mountain of the second trumpet was to be cast into the literal sea. The sea of the Roman Empire is the Mediterranean Sea. What mountain was cast upon this sea with the destructive effects exhibited in the symbolism? The next page in the history of Roman trouble supplies the answer. It brings before us the Vandal nation, which under the first trumpet had settled in Spain. This was the mountain, as the sequel will show. It is no uncommon thing in the prophetic scriptures to employ a mountain in this political sense. Babylon is styled a destroying mountain, the kingdom of God a great mountain filling the whole earth. The Vandal mountain was thrown upon the Roman sea in this way. In Spain, where the Vandals were established, jealousy broke out between two of the leading generals of the Roman army. This led to war between the two sections of the army, owning their respective leadership. In the conflict that ensued, one of them enlisted the aid of the Vandals, who, becoming thus aware of the weakness of Rome, formed the purpose of subverting the Roman power in Africa. In execution of this purpose, the Vandals crossed the Straits of Gibraltar. The breadth across is only 15 miles. Across this narrow neck of sea, Genseric, the Vandal leader, led his people and proceeded with wonderful rapidity and vigor to overthrow Roman power all along the Mediterranean margin of northern Africa. His career was a most successful one, and mostly maritime. He formed a large navy with which he scoured the coasts and islands of the entire Mediterranean almost without opposition. His devastations were widespread and grievous. He carried horses and horse soldiers in his ships, and wherever his ships came to anchor, these were landed and carried fire and sword in all directions. Tidings of these grievous visitations reached Rome. Rome attempted to stop them by fitting out a rival fleet and sending it to Carthage to attack Genseric's fleet, which lay there on a certain occasion. Genseric heard of the approach of the Roman fleet, comprising hundreds of ships. He got ready fire ships, which were let loose among the Roman ships on their arrival. The Roman fleet caught fire and was destroyed amid scenes of terrible confusion, aggravated by the attacks of the Vandals. The Romans got together a second fleet, but Genseric anticipated their movements by sailing to Rome and subjecting it to calamities of a like nature with those inflicted by Alaric. All these evils affected the Roman third of the empire. They involved the sweeping of all Roman ships from the sea and the destruction of all Roman opposition to the Vandals within the maritime area of the Vandal Triumph. Such events could not better be symbolized than by the precipitation of a burning mountain into the sea to the destruction of the ships and souls. They occupied a period of 20 years and bring us to the middle of the 5th century and the sounding of the third trumpet. When the third angel sounded, there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. Ordinarily, a star falling from heaven means the fall of an eminent personage from power. But that cannot be the only meaning in this case because of the effects following the fall. It fell upon a region described as the third part of the rivers and fountains of waters, with the result of inflicting great and fatal bitterness on the populations of the country so described. This does not usually follow as the result of a fall from power. Therefore, it is the military motions of a political personage who inflicts great suffering before disappearing from view that are exhibited to us. Not only a star, but a great star, a blazing meteoric body, not fixed in the regular heavens, but having a wandering and short-lived place in the heavens. A powerful military leader of brilliant but brief career. These features exactly answer to the case of the next chapter in Roman history. When the woes of the second trumpet had subsided, Attila, the king of the Huns, established in the Illyrian third of the Roman Empire, with the recognition of both the eastern and western sections of the empire, became a terrible scourge to the Roman or Western third. His devastations were principally inflicted on the Alpine regions of northern Italy, to which the description the rivers and fountains of waters is particularly applicable. As a characteristic description, it could not apply to any other region of the Roman Empire. The earth is cut up in that region as it is nowhere else, with multitudinous rivers and streams forming a complicated network covering the land. These are fed by the inexhaustible supplies descended from the eternal snows and glaciers, the Alpine mountain range. On these, the rivers and fountains of waters in the Roman Empire, Attila's hand descended heavily. It is needless to recount particulars. Repeat the history of Alaric, and you have substantially the story of Attila. He made war on the Roman Empire on a formidable scale and with terrible effect. Success everywhere attended the march of his barbarian hordes, and desolation marked their track. Several provinces were depopulated by his armies. The only exception was on the eastern frontiers of France, where the Roman troops and their Gothic allies inflicted a check in the obstinate and bloody Battle of Chalons. It was merely a check however. It diverted the course of Attila's victory, but did not put a stop to them. It was necessary, perhaps, to give them the right direction. It sent him into Italy, where his work particularly lay. Here, his power was irresistible. Wherever he went, according to an historian, all was flight, depopulation, slaughter, slavery, and despair. Figuratively, he made the waters of public and private life bitter everywhere, with fatal effect to the drinkers. Wormwood was an appropriate name for the agent of such effects, but there seems a geographical reason for this name in addition. Wormwood, Absinthos, is the name of a river in the Illyrian region ruled by Attila. This river would therefore be as characteristic of Illyria and the Illyrian ruler as the Nile is of Egypt or the Thames of England. It is a happy combination which in the same name gives us the local origin of the great star and the effect which his movements would produce on the Western Roman third. When his work was done, his power and family disappeared. He was a great star while on the scene, but only a wandering star, not a fixed luminary in the political heavens, a meteor which rushed and blazed with destructive brightness and then disappeared in the midst of the destruction he caused. Though the destructive great star of the third trumpet thus twinkled out, the effects of its course were not of this meteoric character. The Roman Empire was going to pieces under these repeated blows. The successive inroads of the Goths and Vandals, Huns and so on were disintegrating the empire of the Roman iron and introducing the clay of the image feet, and they were laying the basis of the modern system of nations. In this respect, they fulfilled an important purpose in the plan of providence. It was not the purpose of God that there should be another universal empire. The triumph of a succession of barbarian leaders, besides inflicting merited retribution on the destroyers of his word and his people, prevented the continuance of power at one center. It broke up the vast fabric of human power erected by Augustus and scattered the energies of the human race over a wide area, with the result of forming numerous centers of industry and refinement in the various capitals resulting from the subdivision of power. Thus was more effectively promoted that work of subduing and replenishing the earth as a necessary preparation for the kingdom of Christ. If we contrast the world of that age with the world of this, we see what has been done. The countries of Europe were at that time largely covered with forest and uninhabitable. Now they are ripe and ready for transfer to that government which is to break in pieces all human governments. This is another among many illustrations of the diversity of purposes served by one and the same divine instrumentality. And the 12th verse of chapter 8 introduces us to what every reader of the Apocalypse has felt to be the obscure symbolism of the fourth trumpet. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. The meaning of this apparently impenetrable enigma is to be found in a contemplation of the events succeeding to those of the third trumpet. Those events involved the eclipse of the Roman sun, moon, and stars in a third part of them. That is to say, a third part of the Roman Empire, the western third, was extinguished, and its place occupied by the kingdom of the Goths. The events of the first, second, and third trumpets, as already remarked, had reduced the power of Rome to the last extremity, the semblance of empire, but with none of the vigour that had for centuries controlled the world. There was still an emperor in Rome, but the barbarians whom the first three trumpets had called into the empire were the virtual masters of the state, and soon became its nominal and actual masters. The emperor at this period was in fact a nominee of the barbarians. He was the son of one of Attila's ministers, Orestes, the foreign secretary, and placed on the throne by that official. The name of this shadow of an emperor, this last of the emperors, was Romulus Augustulus. He was a weak man and a mere tool in the hands of the barbarians, who finally disposed of him in this way. The barbarians demanded that the third part of the revenue of the country should be divided up amongst them. And to this, Romulus Augustulus and Orestes, his father, would not consent. Whereupon the barbarians revolted under the leadership of one of themselves, named Odoacer, in the war ensuing upon which Romulus was overthrown, and Romulus was then compelled by Odoacer to send his resignation to the Roman emperor of the eastern third, that is, Zeno, reigning at Constantinople, and at the same time to make request that the throne of universal empire should be transferred from Rome to Constantinople, and that Odoacer should be appointed the representative of the Eastern Emperor in the West. This resignation and petition was accepted, and for 14 years, Odoacer, king of the Goths, reigned in Rome as the representative of the Eastern Roman Emperor. But even this lingering light of Roman imperialism in the West was to be extinguished as the symbols required. Theodoric, king of the Ostrogoths, made his appearance from the north and in a succession of battles overthrew the power of Odoacer, on whose assassination in 493, Theodoric set up the kingdom of the Goths in total independence of the Eastern Emperor. The Roman Empire then ceased to exist in the Western Third. The result was a state of things exactly answering to the symbols. The Roman sun, moon, and stars were shining insofar as the Roman Empire continued to exist in other parts, but they were under eclipse in the Western Third, which, historically considered, was the principal third, and therefore these bodies, considered as political symbols of the system, shone not for a third part of the Roman day and night. Plainly speaking, the fourth trumpet foreshadowed the extinction of the Roman Empire in the West, in a manner intelligible enough when it is recognized that a political system is considered as the figurative counterpart of the natural universe of sun, moon, and stars. The Roman system, in the third part, was brought under total eclipse by the events following on those of the third trumpet, which is the key to the otherwise dark symbols of the fourth. The first four trumpets having accomplished their work in the West, attention was drawn to the remaining three, in words of foreboding which were amply justified by the terrible events that harassed and afflicted Europe for many centuries after the darkening of the third part of the Roman day and night. John beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, Woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. The meaning of this, it will be our duty to consider in the sixth lecture.